Hello and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday 12th of April with me, Ian Welsh. Another bumper episode this week. A few days ago, I spoke with Amanda Archia from Fairtrade America and Anna Mann from the Fairtrade Foundation about pricing pressures in food value chains and how to ensure that they don't always impact growers unfairly. And to coincide with the launch of a new report from the Orbitas Initiative into the Brazilian cattle sector, I spoke with Niamh McCarthy, Director for Climate-Related Risk at Climate Advisors. That's all coming up. First, though, is some sustainable business news. The European Court of Human Rights, that sits in the French city of Strasbourg, has ruled that the Swiss government had violated the rights of a group of 2,400 older Swiss women by not taking sufficient action to counter climate change. In so doing, the court has put judicial pressure on the 46 governments in the Council of Europe to take firmer action on greenhouse gas emissions. The detail of the ruling is that the human rights of the women to family life have been impacted by the inaction of the Swiss government. Older women are more likely to die in heat waves, which are becoming more frequent as the planet warms. And the court found that the Swiss government was not doing enough at speed to meet its international obligations under the Paris Climate Agreement. Two other similar cases raised by a group in Portugal and the former mayor of French town were, however, ruled inadmissible. Climate activists and some lawyers welcomed the ECHR's verdict. Some European governments were unhappy with the ruling, however, arguing that it was the place of national institutions to protect their citizens. New research suggests that small and medium-sized companies want to do more on climate impacts, but are unable to do so because of a perceived lack of support from government and insufficient funding. Nearly 300 SMEs, businesses with fewer than 500 employees, across 44 countries were surveyed by SME Climate Hub, and the results show a gap between ambition and action on emissions. Action on climate is a greater priority for 44% of companies. Nearly two-thirds said that reducing climate footprint enhances business reputation, and just over half that it is a method of differentiating themselves from competitors. A similar number identified cost savings and return on investment as a motivating factor for action on climate. Of the companies in the survey, 52% said that both lack of policies or government-sponsored benefits and lack of funding were the top barriers to taking climate action. Other barriers included lack of data and the required skills and knowledge. The SMEs were asked to rate their knowledge on some specific climate action points. Among those rated high were reducing emissions in office buildings and equipment and lowering transport-related emissions. Establishing strategy and tracking reductions was ranked as moderate, with supplier engagement on Scope 3 emissions ranked as poor in terms of knowledge. UK retailer Waitrose has signed up to partner with Tony Chocolonely's Open Chain Initiative, which is designed to end exploitation in the cocoa sector. A total of 9 different Waitrose chocolate bars will be made from cocoa sourced through the Open Chain model. The retailer has joined the programme as what is termed a mission ally, the first UK retailer to do so. This means Waitrose commits to 5 sourcing principles, including robust traceability, paying living income wages, and developing long-term partnerships with cooperatives to support farmers and their communities. Other companies committed to open chain include Ben & Jerry's and Netherlands retailer Albert Heijn. Mission allies agree to compete on chocolate but collaborate on cocoa. Open Chain Cocoa is all fair trade certified, but Waitrose pays an additional premium on top of the fair trade price so that living income reference prices are paid to growers. A few days ago, I spoke with Niamh McCarthy, Director for Climate-Related Risks at Climate Advisors, about a new Orbitas report titled Brazil's Cattle Sector Amidst Climate Transitions. Orbitas is a Climate Advisors initiative. We're going to be talking about a new report from the Orbitas initiative, a report into Brazil's cattle sector. Niamh, why don't you start by giving us a very brief bit of introduction to Orbitas initiative?
Orbitas is an initiative of Climate Advisors, which is a global climate change consultancy. The Orbitas approach combines traditional financial analysis with forward-looking economic modeling in order to better understand the land sector risks and opportunities related to climate change. We focus primarily on climate transitions, which are the government, private sector, and civil society actions needed to respond to climate change. And our goal here really is just to provide forward-looking information to enable climate-smart decision-making, which is especially important when historical data can't accurately capture the future impacts of climate change.
Okay, so what were the headline conclusions from your new research?
The biggest takeaway from our research is that the future of the Brazilian cattle sector will look very different from the past. As the physical impacts of climate change intensify, climate transitions will accelerate and introduce disruptive and sector-wide risks, but they can also create significant opportunities. And these are opportunities that producers, supply chain companies, and investors can all capitalize on. For example, a future with climate transitions could lead to lower overall production output and a higher reduction in available pasture land, but it could also lead to a significant increase in yields and producer prices. We found that those that prioritize sustainable efficiency improvements and diversify revenue streams can build resilience and reduce the likelihood of financial losses. But for low efficiency producers, and especially those reliant on land use conversion for growth within their business models, they may need to consider other agricultural activities and revenue streams. And one final thing that I'll note here is that we found the potential for mobilizing significant capital investments for the sustainable technology and practices that really could transform the cattle sector, and also investments in other agricultural activities, which present major opportunities for those who are proactive.
So who was involved in this research and why were they involved?
Through Orbitas, we've been able to build a collaboration across a wide range of PhD economists, financial modelers, climate scientists, and researchers, in addition to the in-house climate-related risk team we have here at Climate Advisors. We also worked with an organization called Apply Brazil to conduct a series of interviews across agribusinesses, across investors, regulators, and civil society within Brazil. And the purpose of that was really to make sure that we considered a range of perspectives, even beyond the 15 authors that we've included in the report.
How would you characterize the Brazilian beef sector right now?
So the Brazilian cattle sector is responsible for almost 10% of Brazil's GDP. It employs over 3 million people. So first and foremost, it's really important that we consider how the people involved can build resilience and maintain livelihoods in the face of climate transitions. From a climate perspective, the cattle sector is interesting in that it's both extremely exposed to climate risks, and it's also a major contributor to Brazil's greenhouse gas emissions. And this means that actions taken to mitigate the worst impacts of climate change will significantly reduce the risks of physical climate impacts on the one hand, but on the other hand, they drive up transition risks for emission-intensive producers in particular, and those that rely on deforestation for growth. It's also important to note here that Brazil is set to play a major role on the global stage in the coming years when it comes to climate action. They're set to host the United Nations Conference of Parties, or the COP30, in 2025. So Brazil really does have an opportunity to lead on climate change action, including through ambitious actions that they could take to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, actions that they could take to reduce deforestation, and all of these actions could accelerate climate change.
And is there an appetite to take that lead, do you think, in the sector and Brazil more generally?
Yeah, I would say so. I think the election of President Lula da Silva has really heralded in a new age for action related to deforestation in particular. There's significant appetite to invest in the bioeconomy in Brazil and to show Brazil to be a climate leader on the world stage. So I'm really excited to see the types of policies that could be enacted in the coming years. And it's especially important to note in a world where over 140 countries have committed to ending deforestation by 2030, that we're in a really pivotal time for climate action in this space.
Yeah, it does feel that the world needs Brazil to be taking a lead in these matters. And the transition from Bolsonaro to Lula da Silva is hopefully a good sign. What does the future look like for the beef sector in Brazil?
In order to assess what the future could look like if the Brazilian cattle sector does not take action to prepare for climate transitions, we used data from producers across Brazil, and we looked at how current profitability rates would be impacted by economic stress events that are common under climate transitions. So we simulated shocks to price and to transportation costs, and we found that most producers would face a more than 80% chance of profitability loss if they don't take action to either sustainably increase production efficiency or to diversify revenues by 2050. And what this means is that current profitability rates could leave producers exposed to short-term economic shocks, in addition to the longer-term economic trends that we're seeing in our report. We then did a case study on how current profitability across different types of cattle producers would fare under our transition scenarios. And we found that producers that have low levels of production efficiency, higher costs for transporting products, and those that have ties to illegal deforestation could face the most risk. And we also saw regional variations in risk across the country in Brazil. Now, the good news here is that the sector has the information needed to start preparing for climate transitions and mitigating these risks. But the key here really is early action in order to increase resilience.
So the report is titled Brazil's Cattle Sector Amidst Climate Transitions. What are climate transitions? What can you tell me more about those?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked because this is an area that I think a lot of us are still trying to understand better in the risk community. Climate transitions represent our collective response to climate change. What actions are needed to mitigate the absolute worst impacts of climate change and to limit global temperature rises to 1.5 or 2 degrees above pre-industrialized levels? So these actions in themselves can financially impact businesses. And the main avenues for impact are reputational, technology, market, and policy and legal risks. And each of these risks have a corresponding opportunity for market leaders. So on the reputational side, if companies are found to have links to deforestation, for example, they can lose brand value. But market leaders can also benefit from sustainable practices. On the technology side, we could see new planting technologies increase yields. But we could also see technology that could siphon off demand, like in the case of alternative and plant-based proteins. From a market perspective, we could see consumer preferences for deforestation-free beef and company supply chain policies that could limit access for some to certain markets. But deforestation-free suppliers could also benefit and they can grow market share within the sector. And then similar risks are evident on the policy side. I think you talked about the EU deforestation regulation recently on this podcast as well. So supply chain due diligence regulations and policies that prevent the importation of deforestation-linked commodities can also restrict market access for some and lead to increases in market share for others. And these are just a couple of examples, but they do demonstrate how climate transitions can materially impact the Brazilian beef sector. And we're already seeing some of these materialize today.
Yes, we have talked about the EU's deforestation regulation quite a lot on the podcast. Clearly a big issue. So how much is the Brazilian cattle sector changing to be in compliance with that?
So I would say that it represents a major trend in climate transition risks and opportunities, and that trend is accelerating. It's not just the EUDR that is included in supply chain due diligence regulations. Other regions are also discussing regulations in this area that require some sort of certification for deforestation-free supply chains. Sustainably focused export markets could become a major focus area as our modeling suggests that Brazil may become more reliant on exports. And we, even under a 2-degree aligned scenario or a 2-degree world, we found that Brazil could have an opportunity to increase exports by 9%. So it's important for the Brazilian cattle producers and market to understand the changing consumer preferences and demands of countries that Brazilian cattle producers export to.
In your research, you use a number of different scenarios that showcase the potential impacts of climate transitions. What are these different scenarios that you looked at?
Yeah, so Orbitas used four scenarios aligned with between 1.5 and 2 degrees of warming to showcase the potential impacts that climate transitions could have on the Brazilian cattle sector. And they also show how different levels of climate action can create material financial risks and opportunities here as well. So on the one side, we have our least ambitious 2-degree aligned scenario, which is based on the inevitable policy response scenario. This IPR scenario is commissioned by the Principles for Responsible Investment, and it's grounded in climate transitions that are already forecast today and are used widely by financial institutions. And then on the other side, our more ambitious 1.5-degree aligned scenario considers an innovation-centric transitions and focuses on low technology costs. And in our model, this scenario drives the highest potential yield improvements and the highest financial mobilization. And the last thing I'll mention here is that we developed four scenarios, primarily because climate transitions themselves are inevitable, but the pace and scale of our collective response to climate change has yet to be seen. Using a range of plausible projections is a really effective way to mitigate the risks and identify opportunities that can come with climate transitions. And this also gives market leaders the opportunity to consider the more ambitious scenarios, and they can also ensure that they're taking all of the necessary actions to prepare for a range of different outcomes.
Many people are very concerned about the overall impacts at 2 Celsius of warming. Did you consider looking at what happens if it's 3 or 3.5?
We considered a 3-degree world as our business as usual scenario. That's a world in which we don't take additional actions to mitigate the worst impacts of climate change. And we have included the results of our business as usual scenario in the reports. I should mention here, this is part of what I said at the beginning with the future of the Brazilian cattle sector looking very different from the past. If we had a world with 3 degrees plus of warming, the physical risks related to climate impacts would be much more costly than the transition risks in that case, especially because the Brazilian cattle sector relies very heavily on rainfall for irrigation. I'll just touch upon very briefly that we did consider weather station data for the past 60 years in our report, and we're already seeing changes to temperature, irrigation, humidity, and more, which are impacting the productivity of the Brazilian cattle sector already.
Let's go back to look at one of your 4 scenarios then. Let's take the least ambitious of those, which aligns with keeping global warming within 2 Celsius. What are the principal risks and opportunities for the cattle sector in Brazil in that situation?
Even in a world that limits global warming to below 2 degrees, the Brazilian cattle sector could still face significant challenges, and there would be opportunities as well. So on the risk side, there's a potential for a 25% drop in domestic beef production, which would make it difficult for the low efficiency and the emission intensive producers to compete, especially as greenhouse gas prices rise. Forest conservation and competition for land could also lead to a 37% decrease in available pasture land, which is equivalent roughly to the size of Afghanistan. So these are significant risks. But on the opportunity side, we also see the potential for an 88% increase in agricultural capital investment, which could enable an 18% increase in yield through technology, through sustainable practices, for example. And producers could also benefit from a 19% increase in producer prices and a 9% increase in Brazilian exports of beef, which I mentioned before. And finally, emerging revenue streams could provide pathways to increase profitability and to build resilience. So some examples here could include carbon markets, integrated crop livestock systems, agroforestry, non-timber forest products, and we also looked at inputs for alternative proteins, primarily sugars, and plant-based proteins. So there are major opportunities for producers to both increase efficiency and to diversify revenue streams here.
So what are the drivers then of these risks and opportunities? What are the things that are pushing forward these changes?
So in the report, we considered 7 major trends that are driving these impacts. I don't think I have time to go through all of them, but I can touch upon a few of them here. We can start with the potential for greenhouse gas emissions pricing, which could drive up production costs for emission-intensive producers and also create incentives to diversify revenue through land conservation or restoration, which could receive additional payments. Land conservation measures and competition from carbon markets and other agricultural sectors could then create land constraints, which would reduce the availability of pasture land and could potentially increase the price of agricultural land in Brazil. And these higher land prices could reward business models based on sustainable yield improvements, so increasing yield on existing land, rather than expanding onto new land, which would be more expensive in this world. This would all mobilize additional investment into technology and sustainable management practices that improve efficiency, because the cost to increase technology and efficiency would be less than the cost to expand onto new land. So these are just a couple of the trends that we're seeing in our modeling, but they do show how transitions can have very real impacts on the cattle sector and the future of cattle production in Brazil.
Bearing those in mind, what are the specific actions that sector companies should consider?
I might sound like a broken record on this one, but I have to keep emphasizing that action needs to be taken early, because time and time again, when we see disruptive industry changes, it's the early movers that typically benefit the most and reduce risks. Just to summarize, I do have 3 main recommendations. So first, I would say incorporating forward-looking projections into decision-making is really important, because historical data can't accurately capture the extent of climate impacts to come. This will require a paradigm shift for many, but our decisions can only be as good as the information behind them. The second recommendation I have is to invest in sustainable efficiency improvements. So there are many examples of sustainable efficiency improvements that we'd recommend, but one example that we covered really heavily in the report is pasture restoration. So over half of pasture land in Brazil is at least somewhat degraded today. And we found that regenerative soil restoration practices could lead to a 310% productivity improvement, even on the most severely degraded pasture lands. And it's important to note that maintaining high pasture quality is really essential to long-term profitability, because only focusing on short-term efficiency can degrade the land and increase the need to expand on to expensive land in the future. And then the third recommendation that I'll just mention briefly is investing in diversified revenue streams. So whether it be carbon markets or integrated systems or agroforestry or the many options that we do discuss in the report, generating diverse revenue streams would really, really help to build resilience to economic shocks. And it would help to better protect the livelihoods of the producers operating in Brazil's cattle sector today. So definitely, I would encourage listeners to read the report for more ideas, because we've included recommendations for each stakeholder group within the Brazilian cattle sector. But these are just some of the highlights that I'd like to mention briefly.
You've mentioned several times the importance of early action, early movers benefit. To what extent are you disappointed that we're still talking about early movers? This has been something that we've been knowing is a problem for some time now, yet we still have to use the language of early movers. That's disappointing, isn't it?
So yeah, I think that one is disappointing, but at the same time, I want to emphasize that the physical risks of climate change or the physical impacts of climate change are much better understood in the agricultural sector than transition risks and opportunities. On the physical risk side, we already see major physical climate impacts happening today in Brazil, right? Comparing 30 years of weather station data to the past 30 years, we covered over 60 years that we covered in the report, we found that the impacts of physical climate changes are already materially impacting the sector. These are the types of changes that the Brazilian cattle sector has already contended with and will continue to contend with. But the climate transition risks are really something that is becoming more widely known as we go along. And, you know, I think this is an opportunity for producers, for supply chain companies and investors to really try to understand the full scale of risks that climate change could bring and the opportunities that they could benefit from if they act early.
Looking forward then, can you give us a snapshot as to what you expect the Brazilian cattle sector to look like in 2030?
Yeah, so 2030 will be a big year for climate transitions because, as I mentioned, over 140 countries have already committed to ending deforestation by 2030. And if the policies needed to get them there are enacted, we could see some of these climate transition risks and opportunities materialize even more quickly than we're seeing them today. And at the very least, I think the sector will have a much better understanding of how climate transitions can impact business models and the need to prepare for both physical and transition risks. Since this is a big part of what we also hope to accomplish through Orbitas, I feel really passionately about spreading awareness of the financial impacts of climate transitions here as well.
It'll be interesting to see how things do develop over the coming years, but it's great that there are solutions emerging and there are potential upsides as we make that transition and as we deal with a world that hopefully is limited to 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius. But for now, Niamh McCarthy from Climate Advisors and Orbitas, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Innovation Forum is pleased to be working with the Fairtrade Foundation and Fairtrade America as knowledge partners at our upcoming Future of Food conferences in Amsterdam and Minneapolis. To help set the scene a bit, I spoke recently with Amanda Archia, Executive Director of Fairtrade America, and Anna Mann, Associate Director, Responsible Business at the Fairtrade Foundation. We're going to be talking a bit about the work of fair trade, pricing in commodity supply chains, and also a bit about what the future looks like. It feels like pricing across many value chains is under pressure right now. To what extent do you think that there's a significant gap between price and value? Amanda.
Pricing has certainly long been disconnected from the value of products that we work in at fair trade, like coffee, cocoa, bananas. This sort of restless search for ever cheaper prices has pretty systemically overlooked the people and communities, folks who depend on them. And This race for quickest profits has really turned the trade of products into a much bigger game of chance. And the highest earnings tend to go to people that are much further down the supply chain than those farmers and workers. What are the drivers of that? Certainly one of the biggest is the imbalance of power in trading negotiations that we've seen for generations in a lot of these commodities, and a real failure to consider critical costs. Costs of sustainable production, an insufficient risk assessment of economic, social, environmental considerations. You know, and you mentioned kind of pricing pressures off the top. And if you look at the root cause of some of those pressure points, whether it be inputs, whether it be logistics and supply chain, whether it be packaging, a lot of those are driven by a long-term failure to capture some of those economic, social, and environmental challenges, whether that be on labor costs, whether that be on climate change and climate resilience. And so we really have to come together and recognize that those costs simply have not been factored in for quite some time. The current system of commodity trade just really isn't built in a way that honors that labor, that expertise, those production inputs of smallholder farmers. And interestingly, we're actually seeing at this very moment a particularly notable example of the inevitable buildup that happens when we undervalue, and that's in cocoa pricing. So you see this drastic increase in price in the cocoa sector, certainly exacerbated by a lot of this additional market activity we're seeing, but the root cause primarily driven by a drop in supply, which is triggered by crop loss due to disease, climate change, long-time increase in cost of productions, and the impact of crippling inflation on farmers themselves. So those years, decades, generations of undervaluing and underinvesting in cocoa farmers has led to this. So that's a particularly prime example of how differentiated value and price has been for quite some time and the real impacts that we are now facing across society.
Thank you. It's inevitable, perhaps, when you have the wrong incentives in the value chain that don't, in this instance, allow for or promote the long-term investment that is obviously necessary. Anna, do you have anything to add to that point?
It is really acute at the moment. What's happening in the cocoa market has really brought that to life, but it's true across so many of the products that we work with that inflation is a global phenomenon and it's incredibly high, and it has been high for a few years, particularly thinking about producers coming out of COVID and the additional costs that they faced during COVID-19 in terms of labor and additional inputs, and so many supply chains broke down at that time. Then into global inflation driven by lots of the geopolitical events that we've seen. And on top of that is climate change. And yet, whilst obviously there are kind of inflation associated with products that we buy, the disconnect between the cost of production and what a shopper will pay for a product is really, really stark. And I think this problem with undervaluing is only going to make all of the current challenges so much worse into the future.
So Anna, what constitutes a fair price then?
For a price to be considered fair, there are so many factors at play on what it takes to ensure value back for a farmer who's worked so hard to produce the products that we rely on. From a fair trade perspective, we obviously have the fair trade minimum price, and we calculate this on cost of production, and we look at what are the cost of inputs, what's the local economic environment for a farmer, what are the costs of trade associated with that product, and cost of export. Shipping can substantially shift the cost associated with purchasing a product. Even though that's a fair trade's heartland and we really talk about the minimum price, it is a minimum. It's what we would consider a floor of a price that should be paid to a farmer. And often it is what we call active because the market price is low, which is really concerning when you think about what that means for a farmer just to cover their cost of production. And then the other key piece for fair trade is thinking beyond what's the minimum and into what should be fair. And for us, we think fair is what enables a farmer to earn what we call a living income. So enough to feed their family, to be able to save, to send their children to school. And in the case of hired labor, a living wage, which is very similar in terms of being able to save and also cover your costs. And that's even further away from the pricing we see.
Amanda, anything to add on what constitutes fair price?
A fair price is one where producers aren't just paid to cover their costs, but they're actually given the opportunity to enjoy secure and sustainable livelihoods. And that's really what Anna is speaking to, right? It's not just this transactional piece. It's really about an opportunity for a sustainable future. I think inevitably this means that both buyers and sellers, so in our case, right, farmers and workers, have to have an equal voice in putting a value on their own livelihoods and choices for their futures. So those costs of sustainable production that Anna's mentioning, right, all of those factors have to come from a calculation not just done right at one end of the supply chain, but really agreed to and assessed appropriately by all actors and by those who are most impacted. So in fair trade, we have 50% producer representation and voice in decision making on fair trade minimum price and premium. And so that fairness comes as much from the process of this decision making as it does from the final outcome. So there has to be equity in the decision making. A lot of folks love to get into the debate with fair trade around, well, the supply demand curve will just sort of work this out, right? That's the best way to come up with a fair price. But we all know that the conditions for that sort of dream state of supply and demand definitely aren't being met currently. And we are very, very far away from that, where both parties have equal access to information, equal access to negotiating power. That's just really not the case. Having these benchmarks in play, whether it's a minimum price, whether it's a living income reference price, are really, really critical to make sure that the voices of producers are heard and that the risks of that empower of balance is really assessed and considered.
Thinking about fair pricing, and I think where the market is going as well, is that it's also no longer about cost of production today, but it is about cost of production tomorrow. And I think thinking about fairness in the supply chain, we've seen this so much that if farmers aren't paid enough to cover the cost of sustainable production, but also to be able to adapt to climate change and mitigate those risks and think about diversification at farm level, then it's not even just a case of a fair price, it's what's the future price. And I think this is probably where the market needs to start waking up a little bit with the shortages and volatility we've seen when thinking about what is fair pricing as well.
Absolutely, and that links entirely back to the point we made earlier around cocoa supply chain. You need to be thinking now in terms of the investment that's required for future cocoa buyers, as well as cocoa buying right now. Amanda, perhaps we can go into this a little bit more detail. What are the root causes then of unfair pricing from the producer's perspective?
We touched on this a little bit already. Certainly this imbalance of power and systemic inequality has resulted in a lot of the unfair trading practices and trading structures that have been placed in commodity trading for many, many years. And it's resulted in this chronic underpayment of farming communities who grow these crops. Other factors exacerbate that, right? Global inflation, those input costs. For example, in Cote d'Ivoire, the average US dollar price of fertilizer, the major driving cost of inputs, applied in cocoa production went up by 57% since 2018. We talk a lot about inflation and the impact that it has on end consumers, the impact that it has on manufacturers, but then we sometimes forget the impact that this inflation has on the actual production and the actual livelihoods of the producers themselves. And that's really, really critical. Climate change certainly, and the cost of investing in climate resiliency and then adapting to the regulation, that's a piece of that. And I know we'll talk a little bit more about that and who bears that cost, and farmers bearing that burden also exacerbates the pricing challenges that farmers have faced over the years. And on that climate piece, I mean, we know that by 2050, 50% of existing coffee land will no longer be suitable for production. This isn't just a question of, are we helping out coffee farmers or cocoa farmers? Are we doing the right thing? This is a question about whether or not there will be a future industry at all for these commodities. There has to be a collective reckoning around the prices we've been paying for decades to producers without factoring in all of these risks, including risks around aging farmers as younger generations refuse to participate in an industry that keeps them in poverty, unsustainable growing practices, the collective wake-up call we're seeing that's demanding that industries treat their suppliers with dignity and regulating that accordingly. So we have to recognize that we must pay more to producers to maintain a future for these industries.
Yes, it's interesting that for many of these farmers, success for them is their children not being farmers. I mean, they actually actively are promoting their children doing other things and wanting them to get out of the industry. And it does always strike me that the root cause of all these problems is the commoditization of these products. The fact that that's how the markets have developed disincentivizes the long-term future proofing that is so necessary and becoming very apparent in both cocoa and coffee.
Absolutely.
So Anna, how can the costs be shared along value chains to reflect the actual value of that part of the chain?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few ways that this can happen, depending on the business and the size of the business that they have. From a fair trade perspective, the way that we publish our minimum prices, but also reference prices for either incomes or wage-based interventions is totally public, transparent, exists for any business as a reference, and is based on the rigorous methodology that Amanda's already spoken through. And then on top of that, from the fair trade side, we have the additional fair trade premium. And that is an absolute critical support to farmers to be able to invest in a lot of the interventions that we've spoken about today in terms of climate change resilience, adaptation, sustainable agriculture. There are still further companies can go, though. Those interventions work at their best through transparent or traceable supply chains. So knowing where you buy from and committing to them in the long term is so important. Really, minimum price that varies year on year and there's no guarantee for the next season doesn't mean very much. Farmers need to know what they're going to earn for every harvest going forward to be able to make those investment plans and being sustainable and resilient. And I think for businesses that are struggling to find their voice, that they're not maybe big enough or got the power enough to necessarily drive change for the volumes they buy. From the UK perspective, we are piloting an initiative that we call Shared Impact that we worked with the Competition and Markets Authority as well. And the idea is to bring together who are relatively small buyers of products into a buying pool, give them the leverage to make a difference at farmer level, and then make sure the minimum price and premium is passed through to individual farmers over the long term. And I think, you know, these are relatively straightforward activities a business can take to make sure farmers are benefiting in the long run.
So are long-term contracts part of a fair trade arrangement?
From a fair trade perspective, in the standards that we have, there are procurement terms and how that works in terms of payment terms and planning up front. But the idea of a 3 to 5 year contract, that is something that businesses need to be prepared to make on their own terms. And I think from what we've seen from the fair trade perspective, if you combine a long-term contract of 3 to 5 years of sales, you give the price protection of the fair trade minimum price, and then you bring that fair trade additional premium in. The difference that makes is phenomenal. A cocoa farmer isn't going to reinvest in new crops on their land or agroforestry or shade trees or diversification if they spent all of their money once and didn't get it again. And so it really is combining those economic interventions of price and premium with that long-term security that you can really drive forward meaningful impact on the ground.
Is there almost an irony in that the potential supply shocks that we've been discussing, might they then mean they're more likely to get long-term arrangements because buyers are now desperate to ensure they do get the supply that they require?
If there's one thing the current market volatility has shown is that, yes, it is poor business practice to not invest in farmers, that you stand to massively lose by not building true partnerships with farmers over the long term. But the market has historically been very quick to forget. It often runs on a boom and bust cycle. Typically, lots of businesses rely on natural corrections in that typically supply will increase as prices incentivize more farmers to come into the sector. They will have more supply again. And I think our worry is with climate change and upcoming legislation and massive shifts in the market, the cost of production is just no longer the same, and those cycles will no longer be able to work in the same way. Land is becoming unviable for production. And I think we worry that whilst it should move to long-term contracts with a price intervention and additional support to farmers, if the market doesn't do that, they will realise too late that that's what they needed to do at this point.
Whilst there may not be regulation coming in terms of long-term contracts or length of contract, there is a lot of regulation that's on the books and coming in through this year and coming months that will have significant impact on all of this. What are the solutions that can help farmers, and particularly smallholder farmers, comply with the new regulation, the EU deforestation regulation, due diligence, all the rest of it? Anna?
I think it's worth reflecting on just what a big ask a lot of these legislations are for smallholder farmers, and that there is considerable additional investment required in meeting those legislations, and that we are talking about supply chains, whereas we've reflected on at the start of this podcast, these farmers have struggled to access the true value of their product for a really long time. The average cocoa farmer lives on less than a dollar a day. And now we're looking at legislation that will change their market access. They will either be able to trade into the EU or they will not, on the basis of whether they can prove compliance with quite stringent legislation, particularly thinking about deforestation. Cocoa cooperatives have memberships of individual farmers, where those individual farmers are based, whether they have engaged in deforestation, whether they're a member of one or two cooperatives, whether that cooperative has a system to be able to track membership, let alone geolocations and polygon mapping. This is all very big asks of farmers whose primary business is trading cocoa. And so I think what we see is that there is a very real risk that if the supply chains don't stand together with those farmers and invest in them, there'll be one of two outcomes. One is they won't be able to trade to the market anymore. They will have lost EU access. They can't prove they're deforestation free, for example. Well, the second is that they will invest everything they have in meeting compliance and new monitoring systems, technology systems, first mile traceability between farmer and cooperative, satellite monitoring. But at what cost? To what other interventions? To what other expenditure did they have? And I think from a fair trade perspective, we're really working through the price and the premium and what they can do to support this. We have our own partnerships and our own standards. But outside of fair trade, it is a very important ask to businesses that they really, really work with smallholder farmers to support them towards this compliance.
And again, maybe there will be a market driver here that will mean that where you have examples of commodities, cocoa being a great example, it does come from smallholder farmers and they tend to be located in Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire. Maybe the market will have no choice but to help those farmers comply with this regulation. In that respect, drive the sector forward.
You'd hope so, but they also have the choice to move volumes elsewhere, particularly if prices are very high at the moment from that region. They also have the choice to shift to what looks like easy compliance, which might be some of the producer groups who have potentially more funds to invest in improving compliance. They might move to a traceable supply chain, for example, which could be great, but who was potentially left behind from that? So there are options available to them, unfortunately, other than really doubling down and investing in the farmers that need it the most. But our hope is, and a big part of the petitions and campaigning we're doing at Fair Trade on this, is to make sure that there is a promise of support to farmers to help them through this.
Ultimately, I guess all of this is going to impact on consumers, because if we don't have our cups of coffee or bars of chocolate, consumers may well end up driving change here. Amanda, I wonder, from Fairtrade's perspective, it's all about the price really, isn't it? And that's as far as the consumer sees, they see the premium price. How does Fairtrade support consumers to understand the value of products beyond simply the price?
I would open with challenging a little bit of the notion, particularly around the idea that paying a few cents more per cup of coffee or per pound to farmers and producers inevitably would result in some dramatic increase in price to consumers, right? We know through extensive studies across product types that usually the raw input of cocoa or coffee usually makes up some kind of single digit percentage of the final value of the product. I think collectively, and certainly industry, should challenge this assumption that they can't reimagine their cost structure at all to minimize risks to both producers and impacts on pricing to end consumers. There's a lot of brilliant people inside the biggest food and beverage companies in the world that I have real confidence can absorb some of these costs that are really necessary for the future of the industry without impacting consumers. I always try to leave that note in there because I think we fall under this assumption that by paying farmers a rate that gives them a sustainable livelihood, that inevitably has to go straight into the consumer's wallet. The reality is, though, is that even if consumers do have to pay more, we don't have an option to wait anymore, right? We see it in the headlines around the cost of your Easter chocolate bunny. We see it in changing coffee landscapes. We see it in a lot of the outdated and unrealistic pricing notions for bananas. So collectively, as consumers, manufacturers, producers, right, we've got to adjust these expectations. I don't think we should underestimate consumers' ability to understand these issues, particularly when the alternative, i.e. severe constraints on being able to get a cup of coffee or buy that chocolate Easter bunny, is way worse. You know, there's this headline recently, Trader Joe's upped its banana price from 19 cents to 23 cents after keeping that price the same for over 20 years. And you can imagine the cost to farmers that have changed over the last 20 years for banana production. You know, yes, some Trader Joe's loyalists kind of balked, like, oh my gosh, 4 cents more. But most people's reaction is like, yeah, 23 cents, sure, that seems reasonable. We do our own third-party studies via partnership with GlobeScan, and we see consistently that 67% of fair trade shoppers are willing to pay more, 35 to 66% more, depending on the product. We do our best to really support those brands to understand the impact and communicate this to their consumers. We increased our coffee minimum price in 2023 and made sure that we were explaining in detail to both commercial partners and consumers that, hey, these costs of inputs for coffee production, the risk of climate change are really critical to making sure that you have access to a good cup of coffee in the future. Back to that study with values alignment, fair trade customers and not all customers in 2023 listed inflation as the number one challenge to address. But issues number two and three were poverty and economic injustice and climate change. So if companies lead with these values, educate consumers in a way that demonstrates with transparency and integrity that the sustainable future of these products we all love requires investments in farmers and workers, and not deeper pockets to those turning a profit, I think we can all have hope for a brighter, fairer planet.
And I guess the fact that so many consumers now accept that climate change is something that we're all in together, as it were, they can see the impacts on themselves. So it's an easy story to talk about the impacts on the growers of the products that they love.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Anna, any more to add on that?
the other piece is not that we shouldn't just estimate how much consumers, like how much they can understand around this, but also how much they want it. There is such a high expectation now on businesses to do the right thing. Shoppers really want to know that when they go and purchase a product, they are doing it with a company that has made the right decisions, that have made fair prices. And Amanda's spoken to a lot of evidence we've collected. And I think it's really visible now to any business working in this space that they need to provide a very credible claim to their shopper on what they are doing to support the farmers and workers behind that supply chain. And with things in the UK, like the Green Claims Code from the CMA, they have to be able to back that up. And there is so much evidence out there now on needing kind of credible, meaningful, evidence-based claims that shoppers want to quickly be able to refer to. So I think it's also a real business case for businesses in doing this from a shopper perspective, because that's what the market really wants to see as well.
And going forward, do you think this is something that increasingly there'll be less resistance from business?
I think the market is changing. I think businesses are beginning to realize that from kind of a future profit perspective, they do need to be making certain investments now. I also think that there are just more and more cases of companies being called out for misleading claims and shoppers walking away from them on that ground, or on the grounds that they think that company is doing the wrong thing and that they do want to be able to spend their money in a responsible way. And they are, as an average shopper, looking for the company to do a lot of the hard work for them. So I think the business case is there now, and I think companies are beginning to shift. Whether they can do it fast enough and whether they can do it with enough investment, I think that's a key question still to be answered.
Absolutely. There are lots of big challenges out there, but there are some exciting emerging solutions that can provide answers. Amanda Archila and Anaman from Fairtrade, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ian.
Full details of how to join both the Future of Food events in Amsterdam and Minneapolis at discounted rates are available on the Innovation Forum website now, which is also, as ever, the place to go for all the latest analysis and interviews. But that's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and until next time, goodbye.